Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's so wonderful to see all of you here on such a beautiful afternoon. The rest of you are sitting there with either soft jackets or soft feet or coat. Your physical discomfort will be alleviated by intellectual good food. I'm really pleased, delighted to welcome Mohammed here to talk about his fabulous new book, which I've had the opportunity to have a good look at. Now, Mohammed is a star, as you all know. I could go through his CV, but if you take it from me, he's just magnificent. What I'd like to say is that I also think this book is absolutely fascinating, and it tackles both a very old and a very recent question. The old question is the division of powers between the centre and the periphery, between federal government and the constituent states. An issue not quite as old as the hills, but certainly pretty much as old as the United States is, and also, of course, an issue of huge significance to the European Union. And I think what makes this book so rich is that it doesn't just adopt the usual observations that all power should be either concentrated at the centre or at the periphery, but asks a much more fundamental question about why it is good to have this separation division of powers on the vertical domain. And what are the circumstances when the centre, the federal government, can act better? And by better, what I think is really marvellous about Mohammed's book is that better is a sophisticated concept, not just a sort of bite-sized piece, that this is clearly things that can be done better at the centre or at the periphery. Now, I think Mohammed's book gives a wonderful case study of why it's really important to carry on studying European law, particularly for those of us who were raised in a system like the UK, which thinks about absolute sovereignty and the fact that the state will do whatever's necessary, although even that is questioned now with devolution, and any SPS agreement that's entered into in the next few weeks will absolutely bring these issues to the very forefront. So, Mohammed would explain all of this far more coherently than I can manage. I commend the book to you very much indeed. There is a sheet going on now. There is a dedicated sheet, I think, has money off those of you who are invited to buy it. And there are inevitably lots of free mentions. But what we're going to proceed this afternoon is Mohammed's going to talk for about 40 minutes or so about some of the ideas in his book. And then we're delighted to have Mark Chestnut online. Thank you very much for agreeing to join us. I realise it must be a pretty early hour with you, who's going to make some very important comments on Mohammed's book. And then I'm going to open the floor up to questions for you. So thank you for letting us have this opportunity to talk, Mohammed.
Thank you so much all for coming today and on such a rainy day. Thank you, Catherine, for a wonderful summer. I'll summarize this book I can ever do. And thank you for all the support over the past years that helped bring this book into life. I'd also like to thank Mark for the past decade, who has been a mentor and provided very valuable guidance on explaining the boundaries. I would like to thank Kappa Allison, who really is a very commitment, a lot of commitment. And before I start, I would like to also dedicate the book for my grandmother, who passed away less than 2 weeks ago, and for also pushing gave her life. So the height of the book, as you can see, is federal impartiality. We want to start around to make a non-impartial statement to get a copy of this book. So you can see the irony. And they both looked at divisive rights in the EU and the US. And the reason I started working in this book started from a very technical doctrinal question: how can we share powers within a federal system?
Which power we gain is beginning in the bill, which power should be gained to the state bill.
But then I realized it's such a complex issue. And the obvious question that came out of it is it worth it? Why do I need to bother with all of this? What is the point of a federal or a supranational union?
Then coming to the country of Brexit,
this question becomes even more important and raises a very prompted question that has implication for all of us. So I think it's sometimes tempting to inform progress to your friends, as this has been used like that they go about the US at all.
But the reality, it do raise intellectually challenging questions.
And one of the questions related to this book that I struggle, and I saw my kind of struggle to respond to, is what is really the point of a union? What's the point of federalism? So the question may be something like this. Why would the union or a federal level be better than federalism?
The law of somebody else
that actually come from the states. So just to make it more concrete, think of any provision you like in the equal pay between the government and the family. I want to be okay with the legitimate question that we have a much older tradition, older colonies, a stronger judicial tradition. Why don't you come and write it down? We'll be as good as the EU, if not better. Why bother with all the complexity? And I really struggled to answer that question. And I had to dive deep into federalism to try to find out how to respond to it. And the key claim I came across is
in the federal claim. It's not what I came up with. That's the claim.
And the federal claim is technically federalism is a remedy, is a cure. Use this word remedy. Two problems that without federalism you cannot fully achieve. The cure majority bias or probably majority hiring.
It would be like, how will you measure for us? Why is it the lack of society on his head?
And this is, you can only see this by the quality of law and the interpretation that comes from a federal level. So it gives you better rights, do less bias, plus, which is even more radical to anything, that people will tend to accept this with less division. So there will be less polarization. So in summary, see on the meme here, that federalism is a very reason for bias as well as polarization. So societies will live happily ever after, less divided through the system. Okay? And the word remedy is chosen wisely for the classical federal literature because constitution is like a medical trial. Constitution is actually what it means a body, someone by heading constitution. So the federal thinker, they think the body has these certain diseases and federalism is the only cure to it. So I started to really test this claim because if I can prove it, then I can go back to my fixed here federal skeptic friend and respond to that question. And my answer, just a spoiler, is actually yes, the two things could work. You can cure bias and polarizations through federalism, but there is a key condition to get the right votes. Most like any other reticent, if you get the wrong dose, be either ineffective or could really be very lethal and harmful. And what do I mean by those is the division of power between the federal and the state. So a strong federal dose is when the European Union, the federal level, is leading, setting the law, setting the minimum standards which could be apart. A weak dose is when the stakes are very. And definitely it's a spectrum, and there are pieces in the middle. And my whole task today is to walk you through is where I think we should take strong dose, is where we should have a lighter dose, and pieces in the middle. Okay? So this table brief, the plan, the discussion. When centralize, when there are strong dose, when not decentralize, and the cases. Okay. So let's start with the first. So to understand the argument for a strong central dose, a key figure here, obviously it doesn't need introduction for American audience, is James Madison. This is the mega brain beat of the US Constitution.
Most likely figure are learned in like history.
However, his argument is surprisingly not very well known
in scholarship as well as for European Constitution.
And Madison was really concerned with the fact that laws within unitary states, something like three revolutions, France, Norway, Tunisia, system that's not federal, you tend to excessively represent one majority bias or majority target bot. Madison would make this radical claim that these are not LBQ, central evidence. And the argument he would make is this in this line, in his most cited paper, The Federalist Number 10. And Madison would say the following: a well-constructed union ensures that no man is allowed to judge his own cause. So he says the word man, but he really means a group. So only for federalism, you can limit groups and make sure that the laws are more balanced and for the interests of everyone. Okay? So for him, that's what's considered the impartiality that federalism can provide. And it comes more impartial towards different groups of the society. And it's important to clarify the meaning of impartiality as well. Has different definitions. It's very important that it's not the philosopher's dream of enlightened angels who have a view of ignorance and have no interest. Madison thinks it's impossible. But people will always have their group bias and their group interest. Logically, we love our groups, we love our tribes, has been developed over millions of years in our brain. So instead, Madison uses a very functional tool, which is the common law rule against bias. So he will try to apply this rule to the federal level as a judge deciding controversies within the states. Okay? But then you are not this enlightened angel and still have bias. How would you control it? Understand? And here's his interesting answer, which is counterintuitive. It's both bias, what he is more bias. And how would this work? Technically, he thinks it's through building a large federal model. That's why his answer applies to large federations like the EU or the US. You harness an important power of human nature, which is diversity. Okay? Once you have a bigger size of polity, it's logical to assume that there will be much more people in it, much more group with much more interest. And this diversity will allow there is actually more groups in the system with there are more biases. But this clash of groups that within the brains of each group will actually know that they cannot meet everyone else and will have this moderating effect in the way they think. Then, so he's not trying to eliminate this bias, but he's thinking that when you decide at the state level, it really works the way that your brain works. You have multiple emotions working, you try to really control them so you can make a rational decision. So try to balance these different rules by one another. And this takes him to his third point, which has epistemic. So this is a fancy philosophical order for our students here. Technically, you have a wider angle of seeing picture. It's exactly like in Europe and in life. If you're really angry or annoyed, you cannot really make a critical decision. So he's trying to control these biases. And once you control them, you can see the picture better. And by the picture, he means the law, the gravitational bound of the common modes. You thirdly have better intelligence. So in simple terms, that the same provision, if you put at the local level, you take it up to the federal level, you actually end up with a clear difference of interpretation, and this because of the element of bias that's controlled. Definitely, you can unpack this argument in hours, but there's lots of assumptions and conditions I fill in the book and respond to modern critiques of Madison. But just to give you a brief illustration of it, let's imagine that we have five states, and each state is unitary, they don't have a union. Each one of them is dominated by one majority. Whenever there is a legal issue or something that they need to pass, a law from tax to economic regulation to racial discrimination, it's easy for one group to decide what they want, okay? But when these states, and look at the yellow circle, join together in a union, automatically the group that was dominant at the state level, it's the end. It was from 90% to 18%. The fact that they cannot dominate automatically will not make them angels, will not make them, do not love their group. They do think of common biases that are more in the band of the group in some sense. So the clash of the strong benefits the weak, which would benefit the minority. There are some limitations for the argument that have figures. I know that we lawyers don't like math, so but I hate it. So I will just quickly for this and I give you the what we're looking for cases. So the argument has been tested a lot in comparative literature on the favorite quote I have on the book by Justice Scalia. Is the famed textualist, just in the US, who is very proud of Madison, and he called this a prophecy that came through. And he went on in his opinion here to collect multiple cases in American history which has proven this magical power trick. He took a provision that discriminates against Chinese America, put at the federal level, it ended up was a minority friendly interpretation. After the merger, same, it will not. Standing minorities is the same. So he would say racial discrimination against any group finds a more ready expression at the state compared to the federal.
Same way. It's not surprising. As people who veneer the army corps.
The PU lawyer said the exam out of stradable to us.
I can give you some examples from the EU.
Our version literally bet my mind that Madison Lord,
he jumped in excitement reading some of the cases of the EU law saying this is exactly what I predict.
This is right, in my view.
So one of the examples is the most central article of EU law, Article 18.
Well, this is doing not EU background without EU background. Article 18 is about
how we integrate the economies and you make sure that no country can pass law that discriminates against nationality.
So technically, no EU member states, France, Germany, they cannot decide to give their business advantage over other businesses. Okay? So this is a great acknowledgement that because if they give them this power, if they decentralize this power, what will happen is they will really be partial toward their own business.
Only when you centralize this, that you manage to build the market. So it is very clear endowment to the
testimony of the theory.
One of my favorite examples is equality. All due respect, I always grant in face of my drinks if you're a federalistic friend. The UK has definitely a very well-respected tradition where it
was a democracy or in terms of equality premium.
But without the EU, the Equality Act had loopholes that allowed literally business to pay women less doing their work of same value, and they get away with it. So the law used to set a ceiling that if you discriminate against women and then you get sued, there is a maximum that amount of damage you get, which is 2,000. So technically, if you run a business, it would make sense to you to discriminate because you can get people who will produce for you. You say to make a lot of profit and then you give them 2,000. Actually, the law is almost telling discrimination. Okay? But once you put this in the EU, once the UK joined the EU, this cannot work exactly because of this argument. Particularly the French industries had more egalitarian infrastructure. And this meant that business from Europe will lose money to the UK because the UK can produce at cheaper cost and then cheat using the market integration to pay women less.
So they stood out to the UK and the force for centralization with that water's intervention. This has been centralized and the damage the UK limits to 2,000 has been removed to some and gains in the pot.
So actually, women with statistics are to be awarded multiple damages. And this shifted the whole dynamic. So the struggle of the strong economies, who actually didn't care to be really sort of about women quality, if you really hear this exact medicine predicted by strong forces, they want to protect their interests. This helped the weaker force, which is women workers.
So by changing the incentives, UK businesses reliably would pay much more money. So he started to recruit these in equal pay.
Okay, so you can see this magical connection. If we realize something, we tend to get more minority-friendly interpretation, and it's not magic, it's just because of the Rasmus part. A very recent case,
Denmark passed a law, anyone who was Danish,
his parents or her parents were not born in Denmark, would be kicked out of their social housing.
Again, this was impossible to pass with the EU. Okay. Only at the national level, and also the EU intervened and prevented them from moving.
Okay? So all of this is to show that the argument, it is theoretical, does work in practice.
There is an empathetic minorities and more impartial toward minorities.
At this stage, I was so excited. I said I would go back to my Rigsteer,
the geoscopic friend, and did hear which so many examples that said the work for the arguments.
But the problem is I spoke too soon.
Realize that there are
they collapse the argument I just presented.
Just to give you an example of it, remember he claimed we are at a certain degree, if the rights, stronger rights, plus less polarization.
So I look at abortion, for example, in America. In 1973, that was a divisive issue. And people thought, okay, if we federalize this and we have a central answer, we'll have this better rights framework as well as people will accept it. So for 50 years, this has been a key polarizing issues. 50 years later in Dobbs, the court reversed track and went to the other extreme of decentralizing. For those of you who are not following, in our southern states, now deputize citizens against one another. Like Texas, if you report someone getting abortion, you get a bounty, literally you go out and collect money for snitching on other citizens. And there are really some unusual laws in this framework. But also, it's not only the social legal framework that became unstable, but also the polarization for 50 years. This has, and Mark has argued extensively in his books, how this actually affected even the composition of the Supreme Court. So he ended up with, like, basically the theory is wrong, the two fronts, unstable rights plus more polarization. So I was allowed to concede defeat, right? That was the violence. So I had to go back and dig a little bit deeper. Read when Madison got this idea. Then I realized that there's Madison's arguments incomplete, and there is a crucial distinction between the plus being a, and that this distinction comes from sources he got this idea from. So Madison was a student of two traditions, the British Commonwealth, as well as the Scottish Enlightenment, maybe if you. And Madison is right that federalism can control bias. In the common law, bias has really different types. So we need to determine which type of bias. Also, Madison was directly copying for some people, ingenious, plagiarizing for Hume, but he gave some genius institutional framework to Hume's ideas. He was really concerned with the same issue that Madison was concerned about, fracture or polarization. And Hume developed this extra category. And stuff like abdurum, just the dying, all these culture war issues, that's a conflict of value. Madison assumed that all people in the system are just blocked by the group interests, but they share the same value. Equal pay, if you read the cases, everyone was making the argument that we're not against equal pay against women. We think it's different work. During the segregation in American cases, people said, why can't African Americans follow people? They said, so no one is denouncing any value. In case of cognitive values, that the old people actually do have different value free. And this is where Madison's argument really doesn't work. And the puzzle point for him that Hume predicted this. And Madison literally has implemented every single sentence Hume adopted in his book, except this category. When it came to the action of principle, this conflict of value, he completely dropped that. And I really didn't know why. And I cannot know why the map. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, is the argument will not work. The whole idea that centralization would bring better framework and reduce bias doesn't work. So this is just quickly for you familiar with the common law. The category, the distinction between bias of group interest and bias based on value or culture war is well established in the common law. It's understandable that this was after Madison, so it's not something that he would known. He would should have known what Hume wrote, but not this. But think, I don't have to go into details for you if you will. Like administrative law, come along, happy to go back in more details. But think of it like the jury or judges. The first question is, if you have an economic interest, this is an economic bias. Are you shareholder one of the companies part of the case? This is the economic bias that Madison was concerned about. There's also group bias. Is there around your family is members? It seems the judge will not be partial. But there's sometimes, and there's a lot of cases, like, you know, shame in the UK, where the judge has been like vocal, for example, anti-abortion judge, or some judge who was really vocal against Pinochet, or so the judge of cases in Scotland, where the judge literally wrote an article saying, I'm not like gonna apply the ECHR. I think it's a gold mine for other people, for lawyers. And then he decided the case the next day. The court said, you're really not, you have an ideological framework, which doesn't make you partial any. And it's literally a question on the questionnaire that's asked to juries, you know. Okay. So just all what I'm saying, is this bias related to cultural war is a different category of bias that Madison should have accounted for. And this is, and why is this? Because, as I said, the true part is the conflict in society here does not reflect group dynamics. People who are divided on abortion don't divide it because they're women versus men, religious. Like, there are people who are religious from different traditions, secular, etc. They all share, they are all across the type, two persons switch. And you can see this clearly in contrasting with Spujart. In Roe v. Wade, the American court denied the right to abortion. There is one. The German court decided the opposite. They decided the right to life. So they are actually thematically opposed judgment. There's one thing common between them, that they do acknowledge it's a clash, explicit clash of values. It's impossible, and they are mutually excluded. The problem with these type of aspects is centralization. That fires automatically. Because remember Madison's argument, remember three bias by more bias. So it requires diversity. Diversity is missing in these things. Because the moment you open this for centralization, people who would talk or conflicting about this, they rally around one another and they build a strong coalition. Okay? And they'll try to impose their worldview across the whole continent. You actually create the opposite incentive. I'm like equal pay, well, you encourage people to accept and defend. This time you encourage the opposite, encourage resistance and coerce. I will pass my view over you. Okay? So you can see these dynamics happening clearly across different issues, and you can see the demographics, like in America, etc. Like the people who are pro-life, little different groups, the cross-group issue. It's not connected to one particular group in the society. The question is what to do then. So one thing is not to do what America did. So you can tweet it also recently. You would see that the judges are fighting over this issue. There is Kavanaugh, also misreading Madison, saying impartiality means let's decentralize this. It's not our business. Other side say like, no, impartiality means that we should centralize abortion. Most solutions were tried in America and didn't work. So what should we do? The EU has a third way. It's actually, not they can make me say, I'm going to leave states to do what they want, or I'm going to impose an answer of them. Question was, I would adopt some unity and diversity. I would allow states to respect the unity of this question. They can ask the same question and reach this activity, closures, all these aspects, allow it or not. We can get different predicting answer depending where you are. Okay? However, states are not free to do what they want as the EU supervises that this doesn't go excessively beyond what is reasonable and make sure that there's no double rightly. And we're based for time, we don't have time for this, but I survey all the judicial and the legislative issues that the EU has managed to develop across time to manage these issues. Never says that completely decentralized them. That's not my business. But also does not impose one. And very recently, at least one answer across all. And these are techniques that are run both by the judiciary and by the like, why this is not just being pragmatic. This actually reflects a strong way of being common. The idea that really you have an empty card. So when issues so divisive like this, no one level, the federal or the state, can decide what they want, right? So you allow social forces. And time is a key ingredient in fertilizer, so people can learn from one another. And this over time, science carried in Israel, they will revive their idea. They set up to find a compromise. Okay, honestly, pluralistic, if it's angry, disagree. Not relatability, independent growth, it's best for the support. There is a problem with you, but I disagree with this reason. So just to give you an example that we've worked around the practice. So in 1973, America had all states, the 50 states, legalized abortion. In Europe, only the UK, in the same year, actually, allowed abortion. Now, slowly through the Smith vote, it's a passive virtue. You cannot see it unless you really chase the cases. Now, most states in Europe managed to find a compromise, somehow that works, without this ugly polarization seat in America, while America went to the other extreme. But I know what you might be thinking, that you might nearly too much into one case. And probably didn't agree with you based on the abortion case. In fact, I do in the book Sabogar Catter in so many cases, when the site is faced by this divisive issue, you can see this other aspect. Once you centralize, it becomes really polarized. Try to take it from the center, people turn to find a solution without getting up their lower position. They actually find some degree in his disagree. Happened in multiple MCs, multiple countries in the EU and the US, and even go to non-Western context. So how actually was the same? People do not try to impose transnational morality. And when they actually left their way, this backfired automatically. So they learned their mistake and went back. Good. So to just recap, my argument so far that this federal remedy, this impartiality, works really well with this illness that when the law is tainted with so much group bias, excessive representation, and the remedy, the dose should be strong one. civilization. And this worked really well. People, April, learning the EU, the EU, British books, and even much of economic legislation, both in Europe and the US. For this other type of cases, conflict of values, or this what the common law calls non-majority bias, what Fiume calls spectrum principle, like abortions, it's a dying, all the other examples. Actually, this third way EU tends to work better to other organizations. Okay. At this stage, I realize that the federalism has these two unique added values, whether through centralization of economic and group bias, or this third option for these divisive questions. And again, I wanted to go back to my friend and really meet my friends. But again, I realized I made another mistake because the two types of conflict, you're always exclusive, right? You can be and have conflict in society, which is reflected in the legal interpretation that goes, that is tribal group bias, as well as Vatican. I'll give you two examples. One of them is funding of Catholic schools in America. This definitely was banned because you were concerned of the Irish and Italian migrant. You wanted to assimilate them into the Protestant majority culture. But so there's group bias involved, but there is also people who believe that the church and the state should be separate, and this is their philosophical view. So there is some philosophical commitment as well as bias and faith. Also, some of the cases now in Europe in which was fought, this have clearly anti-Semitic history. It was Nazi, racial schools are banned, based by their own Jews. But now, when you look at how the law passed, you always find the ultra-right wing parties who hate migrants, imposing them, and really, really kind, nice people who care about animal welfare because of the philosophical commitment. So now could you deal with this? Because you cannot fully centralize or decentralize. And this is where I realized that a perfect study would be religion. Okay? And I didn't want to write this chapter, to be honest, but then I realized the argument would always be complete without it. So it ended up being the biggest chapter at writing for summer. But just a quick wisdom of fun exercise in my view. So what's the difference between these two colleges in Cambridge? Yeah. This is King's College, the iconic Chapel of Kings, also my wife's college. This is my beloved college, Murray Edwards. Okay. So what's the difference between two of them? Since some few centuries of history. One of them has a chapel, this one was a hard chapel. Okay. So what do we get from this? Is Cambridge is a federal union, because we have these 31 colleges coming together to build the federation, which is the university. But the university does not intervene in the church-state, church-college relationship. You know, college was a chapel's church, getting them funds, collecting fees for them, etc. This is not the university's business. Okay? It can be a college that has secular dimension, it doesn't have a chapel. This also the university's business. However, what is centralized, if one of these colleges tried to put one of the students wherever we want, eating what we want, or eating holiday, looking at our little spot, the ELA University with central passage. Seems very obvious and easy, and that's why the moral is just, if any student in Cambridge knows this by heart, it's not something new, right? And even looked at the structure of the US Constitution and the EU primary law, it's literally screaming this fact. Because it has a special clause on the establishment, whether kings can have chapel or not, and one different for, but in the same sentence, on the free exercise, protecting minorities. And the EU is even clear, matrimony very separate and distant places. You have Article 17 determining that states are free to determine what they want. So you have the Irish Constitution mentioning God and sovereignty under God, French Milton secularism, we have Germany, something in between. Some sense, and there is actually very wide diverse image. But when it comes to protecting religious freedom or non-belief as well, like you have the EU has a different power over this article 19, and you have a different charter of provisions. But it seems to be obvious that this is a matter that should be centralized, protecting religious minorities. The matters of church-state relationship should be decentralized, and the court can try to manage the tension when the case brings those elements. Okay, and this will come a lot in the case I mentioned, ritual slaughter and Catholic funding, etc. Okay, the reason I wrote the chapter is this simple truth I found very confusing to courts. So America will literally flip the argument and give the wrong federal dose for each case for the past 57 years. And the EU started really well, got so excited that the EU is getting it right, and then completely went their own way. And it's all causing most legal and social problems. And again, to show you why this federal dose is quite important. So let's start with the US. So the record that argued that you should decentralize the child, right? The question of religion relationship, okay? America did this like almost for a century and a half. And from the then last century, the courts started to adopt the framework that all states must establish. There's a one solution across the whole opinion. So this led to people suing for all these cases. Can we have a nativity scene in front of a mall? Can we have this in front of a court? And the problem has not been only legal consistency. The court actually came up with something that's popularly known, the three reindeer rule. So you can have a nativity scene as long as you put Santa Claus next to it, a reindeer, which became really fact-dependent, and it's really difficult to understand what the law is sometimes. But it's not only because of legal consistency, by the way. Before the court made this move, there was zero cases on this question. Once the court made this move, the huge litigation, number surged, and this become a very divisive, polarizing issue in the society, and there are like coalition means to challenge these issues and strategic litigation, right? But then came the minorities. Again, remember the argument, minorities, Elizabeth is more impartial toward, you should centralize. That was the court was doing this really well until the 90s. The court shifted track. In a case here called Smith, we're going to have more time to go into it, but this is a Native American guy who had to do his ritual practice, and he used some mild drug for this practice. He lost his job because of this. He lost his employment benefits, almost everything. So he challenged, but just stayed well punished. He said, like, hey, federalism, you're more impartial. I read Madison's papers, just protect me. And the court said, no, it's not our business. This should be decentralized. That was outrageous. The Congress intervened immediately, and there was consensus that this must be reversed. And they passed an act, reinstated the law to before Smith. What is more puzzling is that Oregon and struck down this law as it applies to states, saying, no, this matter should be decentralized. So we don't have to take about this. And the judgment was written by Justice Kennedy to see who's paying attention. Do you remember this guy, Justice Kennedy, on the right? It's the guy, remember what he said? He actually said, Madison is great, I'm so proud, minority is, like, should be impartial. He went and wrote a concurring opinion, this should be decentralized. So I didn't know which Scalia to believe. Should we believe Madison that minorities should be protected by the center? Should we give them strong federal dose? Or Scalia was saying, no, it's justified, we should leave. Okay? So for me, that was such a big puzzle. And there's a lot of books writing how these cases made America divided by God. Made America became much more divided by society, partly because of this issue. So let's see how the EU approached the same questions. So in the question of the establishment, remember, King's Chapel, what's the relationship between the state and the church? The Court of Justice really takes 10 out of 10. So maybe the court tries to steer away, but don't have a three-year rule. It's really unlikely to rise. The court will never intervene in these issues. And even there's a nice case from Spain that came about founding Catholic schools as connected to Rome. The court really didn't use religion, just made a very economic state aid analysis and acted very functional. Didn't try to impose in your Spain. And even the best case maybe is Egergarder. There's a case that involved both discrimination and the church in Germany. And the court really managed to get this right balance of decentralizing one issue and centralizing the other. It's very in nice harm. So I got really happy about reading these cases, and I thought the EU managed to get the balance right. But then came the Hayes Park cases or the religious clothing cases, and the court went even beyond all the critiques that I've mentioned against them. And just a summary, in Ashbita, like most of these cases have something in common. A female employee would lose her job or would deny the job or get fired after being serving in a company for several years because she decided that she had a religious awakening and she wanted to wear a religious garb. So in these cases, the court will develop a rule that probably is fine. The only thing, the only compromise is you don't have to fire them if there's a job at the back door, so no one can see them. On this could be illegal. Then that's got pretty. If the other tests only didn't work, the genuine test, she can prove that one of that applies, and it's very low threshold, can get triggered by seeing someone wearing a Jewish kippah or a headscarf, a hijab, or sikh turban, then it's, all right, remember, in a offerage, you're trying to make money. You shouldn't lose money to protect these people. Anyway, this is severely critiqued, but it's not my business actually to rehash these critiques. My whole idea is to look at this case, because these cases led to the buildup of CSRL. It's the biggest puzzle in the book, maybe. Belgian legislature said this is unfair for a lot of people working who lose their job. So they tried to, remember in America, the court said, okay, this should be decentralized. So if you want to protect Native America, just go at the state level. It's not our business. So the Belgian legislature said, maybe it's like America. Let me go and offer a law that will protect all these religious minorities and help. What the court did here, the case was referred to the Court of Justice, a picture was derived from the advisory opinion, said, and this is part of it. It's a good solution. Yet if it's resolved at this, even though we lie, that takes the agrees with a different one. But surprisingly, everyone, the Court of Justice did not. So issued a veto against, like, against national policy. National parliament also cannot legislate to protect religious minorities, which is, it's very puzzling case. I take no joy in critiquing courts, but I try to justify it in every certain way, and it doesn't work. Okay? There are difficult cases, sure, where individualism will struggle with, and this is laid out in the book. I have time to go through all of them. But what I will say is that the classification we offer today, difference between having ideological bias or human bias, even matters of training. So in text art cases, you see a nice constitutional duel by Advocate John Pocket, who said, that's an ideology issue. You should have a very hands-on approach, very close, not far good. So banning people from wearing religious clothes is actually like someone, an employer banning someone from wearing a MAGA hat or Arsenal cap. Okay? Our very own Advocate John Schwarzenegger, for those who don't know her, to a Jewish professor, I mean, up the general of the court, but it's from PQI. I don't have a group bias, but I think she has really very unique. This is exactly a group issue. You're asking these people exactly as if you asked like an African American to take their skin off by asking them to take their sign samples off. And she suggested that we should have a stronger preview. You wrote one of the best opinions in Bognami and Babi as well. Okay. Just to recap, and so my argument so far has been that federal impartiality does work with group bias and with economic bias, and where strong dose should work, and we cover cases of racial equality and equal pay. Doesn't work. We should have a light dose approach, the middle way approach, when it comes to cultural war, conflictive values like abortion, assisted dying. Is it like religion? Things become more complicated. You would have things where you would have to use both elements. And so you can murder as a good example of the book, how you redo this. And there are cases where courts have really dreamed, got their own answer. Okay? So, in conclusion, I actually think, I repeat, that federalism can be attributed to bias, understood what kind of bias it is, equity, and polarization. If you have a right dose, then you might end up with your impartiality. Or validating some tolerance, redistribution. However, giving the wrong position, you might end up with no impartiality and more polarization.
So this fucker could be here. Could be a piece of selfish, but just breaking to that, we found.
Thank you.
Thank
Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's a great honor and privilege to have you. I hope you heard Mahavid's magnificent presentation of his extremely sophisticated and nuanced ideas, as well as yours to comment on it.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be able to comment on this really, really interesting book, which I think makes significant contributions to the theory of federal organization. I want to begin by noting that I will say almost nothing, a bit at the end, but almost nothing about EU law. I tell a story about 35 years ago. I actually made a deliberate decision not to try to systematically learn and keep up with EU law. And so I only have a sort of very passing knowledge about specific aspects of EU law. I will say something a bit at the end, but it's much less informed than my main comments, which come from the perspective, of course, of a US person who was interested in, among other things, the theory of federalism. That, for me, the theory of federalism material was the most enlightening and interesting aspect of the book. I want to begin. I have two main points to make. The first deals with the distinction among types of policies or conflicts or that arise in extended polities, to use Mazza's terms. I found, actually, I learned, I hadn't realized, the importance of the distinction among the three types of political tensions that Muhammad identifies and in particular, I hadn't realized that Hume distinguished among three types of conflicts or tensions, and Madison addressed only two. And I want to say a bit about that. So the Hume distinguishes, as you've heard, among interest-based conflicts or interest-based movements, passion-based movements, and principled-based movements. Howard points out that Madison's account of federalism is deals with the first two, but not the third. So with interest-based tensions, extending the polity works to protect the public interest because basically deals get made on the national level, trade-offs occur. It occurred to me, I wouldn't want to formalize this too much, but that what happens is that there's when one side gets some of what it wants, it pays off another side, so it gets some of what it wants, and when you put that, all that together, everybody's better off. With respect to passions, Madison's argument is that they cancel each other out on the national level, on the central level. And so you don't get bad passion-based decision-making. The final category is the principle-based tensions. And here, I want to note a couple of things that sort of reorganizing some of the things that Muhammad says. I wonder why doesn't Madison deal with principle-based conflicts? And here's one possibility, speculation. At the time he was writing, I'll put it this way in strong terms, the only principle-based conflict arose out of religious conflicts. And his solution to that was to deny jurisdiction over those conflicts to the national government. So they would exist on the local level. There could be, in some sense, local oppression based on religion, but the national government would not have authority over it. Another, and in the initial constitution, the solution was, U.S. Constitution, the solution was to enumerate the powers of the national government in a way that would, as he argued, I think in a different paper, maybe it is in Federalist 10, the enumeration would preclude the national government from having authority to address these principle-based issues. Okay. Now, it turns out that, and then under political pressure, he proposed and Congress adopted the religion clauses of the First Amendment, which further denied jurisdiction or explicitly denied jurisdiction in the national government over religious matters. It turns out that the enumeration strategy fails for reasons that Muhammad discusses in, again in different terms. Even in the context of religion, and then even more so as the culture war issues extend beyond religion, they become intertwined with matters like employment, over which the central government clearly has enumerated power. And so the strategy of avoiding national government implication with principle-based decisions, conflicts, by denying it jurisdiction fails. Okay, I'll come back to that in my final comments. But I do want to stress that the organization and the identification of these three different kinds of tensions or policy issues and the analysis of how the national government or how extending the polity works with respect to the first two and doesn't work with respect to the third, really quite illuminating and as I said, a real contribution. Okay. Now, my second major point is that as Muhammad's argument indicates, the mechanism that Madison identified is to sort of, when you get these local state-based, in U.S. terms, political movements and interest and passion-based. And then they are aggregated at the national level. He's got these diagrams that show little circles that get embedded in a larger circle. And he explains how Madison argues that when you do that sort of embedding, the interest and passion-based mechanisms that he describes work. That model is placed, again, Muhammad and that acknowledges, is placed under some pressure with the emergence of nationally organized political parties in the United States. And the footnote here about the EU is that nothing similar has yet occurred, nothing similar power has yet occurred in the EU. If you have national-based political parties, then the separate things at the local level might not happen. The little circles might look the same everywhere. Now, that's not true if the national political parties are organized in the states, if the national political parties are themselves aggregations of state-based political parties. And that was true in the United States for a very long time, probably until the late 20th century. If you have these state-based national political parties, then the kinds of mechanisms that Matheson talked about as occurring at the national legislative level will operate within the parties themselves. And so it's a sort of two-stage process. The little circles get embedded in two larger circles that do the, where the Madisonian mechanisms operate. And then those two larger circles operate in the national government, but they're sort of, they're shells. The national parties are shells for the little circles that were there originally. If, as has happened in the United States, the national parties become nationally organized rather than state-based, then the Madisonian mechanism doesn't work. If you don't have national political parties as aggregations of state-based parties, but rather as truly national parties with uniform policies applied in by every state-based party. Every state Democratic Party has the same agenda. Every state-based Republican Party has the same agenda. Then the Madisonian mechanisms are just not going to work. And I think we may be seeing that occurring in the United States, that the Madisonian mechanisms no longer work, even with respect to interest-based and passion-based conflicts. Okay. Now, as I understand it, the EU does not yet have, may never have, political parties organized across national boundaries in the way that the US has. And so the way these things play out in the EU may be permanently or for a long time different from the way they play out in the United States. Those are my major comments. The first is the very interesting discussion of the way principle-based conflicts don't fit into the Madisonian mechanisms. And secondly, the implications of the emergence of truly national political parties. I said I wanted to conclude with just a little comment about the EU solutions as I understand them, both from general reading and from Hammond's book, which is that, as he puts it, the intermediate solutions, which I think he associates with the principle-based conflicts, those intermediate solutions depend upon judicial resolution through, I would put it, maybe this is not his way of thinking about it, through the idea of a margin of appreciation. That is, states have latitude, member states have latitude to make decisions on their own, not subject to national, subject to supranational regulation, but within a margin of appreciation or within bounds. A couple of observations, thoughts here. One is, at least in some contexts, as I understand it, the articulation of this intermediate position is that the bounds might narrow over time as a I think the terminology sometimes is European consensus emerges. And I wonder whether that will in fact happen with respect to the what Mohammed calls the culture war issues. I don't know enough to be confident about what I'm about to say, but I have this vague sense that the existence of a, at least for a while, quasi-consensus in many member states about the regulation of abortion, different from the U.S. Approaches, that the that consensus has in fact constrained or narrowed some of the margin of appreciation that had existed before the consensus emerged. And if that's so, the distinctions that Mohammed wants to draw get shifted from things that happen at the national, at the supranational legislative level to things that happen at the supranational judicial level. That is, the courts are going to be doing these resolutions. And that would trigger, particularly in the culture war kinds of contexts, the kinds of concerns that are associated with the literature on juristocracy, courts taking over legislative tasks, or inappropriately taking over legislative tasks. Okay. Well, so I just leave it there. I wonder whether the intermediate solutions are that Mohammed talks about are in the long run stable. But okay, so those are my comments. I really commend the book. It is really quite illuminating, and I feel sort of odd being acknowledged in the book. This is all Mohammed's work. I sort of said, yeah, go ahead, keep going, so I appreciate being asked to comment on it. Thank you.
Well, a huge thanks, Mark, for the immensely generous and highly pertinent remarks. It's really wonderful to have you here. So thank you very much indeed for the time you've taken. So we now have time for some questions for anyone who would like to ask. Go ahead. You give